Hey everybody, Simon Rettner here. Welcome to The Checkout. Before we bring you our program, we have an announcement to make. The Checkout is teaming up with WBGO and the French Embassy to present our second concert in our series at New Blue in Alphabet City, New York City. We're going to be presenting an awesome French-American ensemble called Thiefs, blending hip-hop, electronic music, and politically pointed spoken word, featuring the bassist Keith Whitty and the French saxophonist Christophe Panzini, along with David Frazier Jr. In addition to that, we're also bringing you a concert by the artist known as Big Yuki, who basically epitomizes what modern jazz sounds like today, drawing from influences from Kenny Kirkland to Chopin and A Tribe Called Quest. In his new recording, it's called Reaching for Chiron. Two incredible ensembles on one night on Friday, November 2nd. And you can get information about tickets at newblue.net. Nobody improvises with a band quite like Mark DeClivelo, our guest today. The grand pianist and jazz technologist who fuses acoustic and electric sounds brings his new quartet to Berklee College of Music as part of our Checkout Live series next Wednesday, followed by an appearance on Thursday at the Brick Jazz Festival in Brooklyn. In fact, you can watch our special webcast with Mark DeClivelo, his Berklee concert from Cafe 939's Red Room on October 17th at 8 p.m. on Facebook Live and on our homepage at wbgo.org. Joining DeClivelo on piano, keyboards, and live electronics, the band also features Teodros Avery on saxophones, Corbin Jones on bass, and Gene Coy on drums. Months ago, I got a chance to talk to DeClivelo about what I thought was his most compelling recording to date, actually one of my favorite jazz albums from 2017, Live at the Blue Whale on Ropadope. It's one of the only recordings that I know of where a band leader samples his own musicians in an improv scenario, in real time. In this podcast, Mark talks a little about his process, but if you want to learn really how he does his thing, we made an amazing video teaming up with the Jazz Night in America team from NPR Music. We created a great video where he explains and compares his artistry to the hip-hop term known as the needle drop. You can watch that video by going to NPR Music or any of our social media channels. Check out from WBGO. Now we bring you our conversation with Mark DeClivelo. Thanks for checking in. There are a lot of uncertainties in the world of jazz. It is certainly the case in this interview. I really don't know an air date yet. I don't know exactly how it's going to be framed, but one thing is certain. I have huge plans for Mark DeClivelo in the coming year. This interview will hopefully supplement that. Mark DeClivelo has released his latest offering to us on the Ropadope label, a live session at the Blue Whale with some of LA's finest, Josh Johnson, Brandon Eugene Owens, Gene Coy, and Mark DeClivelo, the pianist, keyboardist, and on the what, O's and ones? That's what Robert Glasper say, or that's what the cool cats say, on the ones and twos.
Threes and fours, you know, sevens and eights. That's funny.
Or we're just going binary, right? It's a binary thing. It's digital, right?
Zeros and ones then.
Zeros and ones.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'll say on the zeros and ones because I have come up with a concept show for Mark DeClavlo in the fall. Hopefully he will graciously accept. I haven't actually proposed it to him yet, and I'm going to do so right now in this conversation. But Mark DeClavlo, thank you so much for joining us on the checkout and to just hang at the moment.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me. It's good to hang.
One of the best concert experiences that I've had in the last 5 years was seeing you with Josh Johnson, in fact, and maybe some of these other cats at your residency in LA, where you're sort of experimenting, dabbling with this concept of having a jazz band, but bringing your sampling, electronic, dance music, chops and skills in a real improvised setting. Basically, you're doing real-time arranging to create incredible moments that are jazz moments. And I don't really know of anyone else that is doing this as well as you are, at least. And so it's a great honor to even talk to you about this stuff to begin with. And why don't we just give our listeners a little taste of it? Let's begin with something from the live at the Blue Whale. This is recorded live, y'all. Evergreen. Thank you. And we're listening to Evergreen with Mark DeClavelo. If you're in New York City, and in terms of like who you would like to sample, if money weren't an option, who would you pick?
Oh, man. Everybody? I definitely have my favorite guys here. You know, Marcus Strickland, Keon Harold, Robin Eubanks.
Trombonist, trumpeter, saxophonist, respectively.
Yep. All those things. I mean, there's so many drummers here I love. You know, Harlan, Hutch. And then there's so many older cats here who I think may well be resistant to the idea, but just to get some of them in that context would be crazy. That's the thing about New York. It's like you got a laundry list of players. I go through my top 20 trumpet players and there'd still be, you know, 20 more who are still in the top 20, you know?
And that's what the difference between here and LA, right?
Well, the sun's always shining in LA. That's the difference between here and LA. Let's be real. But the quality of player here is extraordinarily high. I do think in LA, the quality and breadth of concept is extraordinarily broad and high.
Literally, too.
Literally. So to be able to, I love the idea of bringing those two things together. You know, bringing together concept and execution, which I think every musician is really aspiring to anyway. But there's something about the culture in New York that maybe it doesn't fully allow for concept to break out of its box in the way it can in some other places.
Besides all the modern cats you just listed are sort of within the range of your generation, I would say, Mark DeClavelo. But on this record, you pay homage to the legends, some with us still and ones that have passed. And let's continue on this journey with your dedication to Yusef Lateef.
This piece, it's called L and H, and it was actually born from a Yusef Lateef composition called Love and Humor. Every time we play it, we use Yusef's compositional idea as a springboard, and we see where it goes. It becomes like a real-time, organic, live-sampled hip-hop thing, but it's always different how that turns out. Even though, you know, one could listen to this and be like, wait, what's that got to do with Yusef Lateef? For me, in concept, its inception is Yusef.
Thank you.
That's Mark DeClavlo playing music from Live at the Blue Whale with his band, comprised of Josh Johnson, Brandon Eugene Owens, and Gene Coy. We both know that Yusef Lateef is more of the unconventional with his approach to music and thought patterns. When I have this idea of you, what if we got like Edmar Castaneda plays the Colombian harp? Or what if we got these other kinds of players here that are in New York City that defy category that can also play a solo set? What if we would introduce someone like that to the table?
I love that. I mean, part of my thing is, you know, how do I reach outside of my own paradigms? Since I moved to the States from the UK, a lot of my collaborators have been very much jazz bass musicians or straight up just they're jazz artists. But it's when the collaboration extends beyond that that it gets really interesting. I did a show in LA a couple of years ago remixing Chamber Group doing Debussy and Ravel. And that was just a whole other modality. I love that. I have another project exploring my Japanese heritage using traditional Japanese instrumentation.
You're also from New Zealand. You're not just Japanese, right? You're like a mix. You're half and half, right?
Exactly. Half and half. Or as the Japanese say, double. It's like, I'm not half and nothing. I'm twice as much. But yeah, all of that stuff, it's like if I'm making beats and sampling records, I'm not just going to be looking through jazz records. That moment of inspiration can come through anything. It's kind of the same idea, but the reverse execution live for me. It's like, let's create the sample out of what we're playing live and then see where that takes us. It's exciting, in fact, to use that as a nucleus to bridge genres, generations, and cultures.
That's Mark DeClavlo paying tribute to Sun Ra on his recording Live at the Blue Whale. Sun Ra did everything differently from everyone else, including how to run a band and even how his band sounded like.
Yeah, man, he was absolutely one of a kind. His concept was different, but you can hear how firmly rooted in the tradition he is. But then at some point, he decided, I am an alien, I'm going to take it somewhere else. And there's no rules. And I love that. It's like in music school, you get taught certain rules of theory, but the rules are there to be broken. I mean, you have to break them to experiment and find out what's possible and what's not possible, and then hopefully make the impossible possible.
Well, I think, Mark DeClavlo, as observing your work over the last decade, this record is by far your most potent statement to date. Do you feel like you're maturing as an artist? You're getting this down?
Yeah, for sure. Kind of central to my journey is that I spent 10 years in the UK, and in that 10 years, it was all about the club and the dance floor and the beats and the drum machine and the remixing. I literally didn't touch a piano for a decade. I'd have producers saying to me, yeah, Mark, let's put some piano on this track. And I'd just be like, nah, man, let's get the synth, let's get the Juno. Or like, Mark, do you wanna come and play a trio gig? It's like, nah, I don't. So it's interesting moving to LA. It was actually my now wife, Nia Andrews. She is an amazing singer-songwriter. She had her debut show and she wanted me to play piano. So I was like, yeah, cool, I'll play Rhodes. She's like, no, I want you to play piano. And there was a baby grand in the venue. So I played piano for her show. It was a genuine reconnection with an old friend. And from that point, I just started exploring that again. And the interesting thing was that over a decade, I'd lost a lot of technical facility, but I'd gained a whole different ear as a producer, and I had a concept that I could share. Over time, the piano has come back into the picture, basically. And so that's been fun to play in general, but then also with this record, with the Live at the Blue Whale record, it's there. I mean, it's part of the rig. And for me, that is kind of the glue between what I do with technology and electronics and playing with the band. The piano kind of bridges that. Thank you.
That's Mark DeClavlo.
Josh Johnson on the flute. And Sunraz, the Golden Lady.
On this recording, you pay homage to another legend that is with us, fortunately. Let's listen to Mark DeClavlo's tribute to Ahmad Jamal. And he does play 88 keys. I don't think he's ever touched a synthesizer, in fact. Wait, he did in the 70s, didn't he?
He sure did. There's a few records with him playing Rhodes. I haven't found one with him on synths, but there is one on digital piano, like digital piano sound. Yeah. But for me, along with Herbie, McCoy, Kenny Kirkland, he'd be number one in there.
Joins us on the checkout. We're listening to his recording live at the Blue Whale in LA. And you were running things at the early age of 20 that had nothing to do with music.
Yeah, so it was my only time ever having what they call a real job, right? So I spent 3 months. I was the national head of marketing for Technics Panasonic in New Zealand. It was fully corporate. It came with a secretary and a car and all the perks. And I was 20. I'd never had any experience in anything except for playing gigs. So somehow I got this job, right? They sent me on a dealership tour around New Zealand to tell the dealers of my 5-year plan. And this is something I knew nothing about, right? So they get my opposite number from Canada to fly to New Zealand and train me while we're doing the dealer tour. This gentleman, so I was 20. He would have been maybe early 40s at that point. His name was Merv. Merv and I met at the office, and I had a gig that night, like a trio gig. I was like, oh, I'm playing. Do you want to come out? So I said, oh, I'll come out. So he came to the trio gig, and then we were at the office the next day.
This is when you were still playing the piano, before you went off the piano for a decade.
Yeah, exactly. This was prime piano time before I was tripping over drum machines too. And so I see Merv in the office and Merv's like, I want to have a word with you. He's like, when I came to see you last night, that was you. When I saw you at the office before that, that's not you, man. And he goes on to explain to me, when he was younger, he was an aspiring young jazz piano player. And this corporate job came along and he took it. And he said he promised himself if he ever came across someone like him again, he wouldn't let them make the same mistake. And I was that dude. So then we go on this dealership tour of New Zealand together. I'm lying about my 5-year plan for the company, knowing I'm already going to quit. And he's just talking me through it the whole way, you know, talking about music and what that life means and how this is not the life. Get back home to Auckland. I went to tell my parents I was going to resign. And I had to take Merv with me because they weren't about to let their son give up this amazing job with everything, you know. So he was there and he shared his experiences. And yeah, my parents somehow got it. And that was the end of my corporate career. It's a good experience to have. And I think of him now and then too. When it comes to mentors, that was a very key mentor. We had very little time, but he helped facilitate the path I was to choose.
Well, I want to also know how you talked your way into getting an executive job at the age of 20.
No, but what happened was I was in Japan for my last year of high school. I came back to New Zealand. I was enrolled in law school. On the first day of law school, I woke up and thought, no, I'm not doing this. I'm going to do music. And that was fully informed by my year in Japan, actually, going to jazz clubs and just really falling in love with that culture. So I come back from Japan. I'm not doing that. You know, my dad was knocking on my bedroom door. It's like, Mark, it's the first day of law school. It's like, yeah, I'm not going. Doing music. Went back to sleep.
Whoa! What did your dad do? Did he, like, have a temper tantrum?
He was old school. I tried to quit the piano when I was 11, but I was so scared of him that all he had to say was, you know, after I had my tantrum about, I don't want to play piano anymore, I hate it, which is because all my friends were playing sports instead of doing music. He was like, go and practice right now. So, okay, Dad, you know, I was scared of this man. So it was quite a step, like, I guess.
To refuse him.
Yeah, so almost a decade later to be like, no, I'm not going to law school. I'm going to do music.
And the look on his face.
Well, my bedroom door was closed, so I didn't get to see the look. Which is probably just as well. Once that happened, every morning, I was still living at home. I get up at some hour, go into the kitchen, and my mother would have gotten the situations vacant, the job listings from the newspaper, and circled anything she thought might remotely be relevant to me, and she'd leave that on the kitchen counter. So I walk into the kitchen, it's the first thing I see every day. You know, she'd be circling things that I was like, I don't care about that. Then one day, there was this job offer. Technics Panasonic National Marketing Manager. And so she was convinced that I should apply for it and that would be good for me. I didn't know what I was getting myself into anyway. So I just went, did the interview, got called back, did another interview. There were two key things. One was that the guy who used to be in the position was too old to be doing a contemporary marketing kind of thing. So they wanted someone young, but I don't think they wanted someone as young as me. They wanted someone who wasn't super corporate. And the head of the company, the parent company is called Fisher & Paykel, which I don't think they have in the States. But like in New Zealand, every refrigerator is a Fisher & Paykel. They, I guess, own Technics Panasonic in New Zealand. And so the head of Fisher & Paykel, he's interviewing me, and there was a 50-50 chance that he went to the same high school that I did. I knew that he went to one or two schools. And I remember dropping that in the final interview, and it was. I think there's a little bit of old boy nepotism going on. Which is weird to say with a corporate job, which has everything, but I think that counted for something. It was a trip actually experiencing a few months of corporate culture at such a young age and just feeling in my bones, like, this is not for me. And that was great to know. Because I guess if you never do that, you could wonder, it's like, well, I could have got an office job. But if you know that's not you, like from experience, that's empowering.
Now, even though we couldn't see the expression on your father's face, he must have had some words.
He was pretty quiet because he knew I'd made the decision. So there wasn't much discussion about it. He was a self-made man. he went to Japan when he was young and developed himself as a trade entrepreneur between Japan and foreign countries for import-export. And he kind of designed his own field. So I think there was an element of him that liked to see that in me. Like, I'm not going to just do this job. I'm going to do my own thing. He did have a problem with, I mean, even drum solos. Like, he came to a jazz trio gig one time I did. It's like, yes, it was good, but I don't know why you have to have drum solos. I was like, wow, okay, Dad. And then one time I did a solo piano show. He loved that. Oh, my Lord, he loved that. Then my first record, which was electronic, it was called 6 Degrees. And that album came out. It had a great buzz in New Zealand. And at some point, I played it to him. And it's, you know, to me, it's very musical. It's thick of harmony. There's melodic themes, but there's drum programming. And so I had this on, and he's like, it's not even music. Where's the melody, right? And he said that actually at the exact time moment that a track was playing off the record that to me has the strongest melody by far on the record. He's like, where's the melody? It's not music, it's nonsense kind of thing. So yeah, he always asserted his opinion.
Mature enough to where it didn't affect you too much? Because that, coming from your father, that could destroy somebody.
Yeah, it didn't faze me at all because he wasn't a musician. You come along, and here comes trouble. You come along, and I'd already had time before that, like in high school, you know, getting heavily into early 90s hip hop. I lost my heart and my head went too. When I sit and think about the money I blew, I wish I would have. As soon as he'd leave the house, I'd be putting records on full blast. Sometimes he'd come home, I wouldn't hear him because the records would be so loud. He's just walking up behind me, you know. I'm just writing the speaker. So he definitely, we had that precedence where he knew that I do what I do. But he was a pretty strong-willed, overbearing, Victorian-style father. I'm glad that I didn't feel trapped by that. He knows that I got into music through his records as well. He had a lot of big band stuff, like Basie, Ellington, Glenn Miller. A lot of Glenn Miller.
Glenn Miller?
Right?
That's just kind of...
You know, okay, you know what's funny? So my dad passed away maybe 4 years ago now. One piece of music I associate with him very heavily is Glenn Miller, String of Pearls. I came to New York this trip. I came to Newark and caught a, you know, got a car to come in. And I got in the car and I was beat. It was a red eye. I was tired. The guy was like, let me know what you want on the radio. I was like, man, it's cool. Whatever you want. I don't really care. And about a minute later, he's like, you know, maybe, you know, you might hear some jazz and you can chill out and rest. And he was a young dude. I was like, wow. It's like, you know what I need better than I know, you know? So he put on WBGO, and String of Pearls was playing, Glenn Miller. And it started, and I hadn't heard it for so long, and the intro is not the theme immediately. So it started, I'm listening, I'm thinking, oh, they're playing some 30s big band stuff, and then there it was. That was kind of a moment for me. When stuff like that happens, I feel like that is the connection with my dad and that he's approving of what I'm trying to do.
Has he ever said it to you just outright?
This is the kind of dude who never said he was proud of you, never said sorry for nothing or please. So he didn't, but he did tell his friends he was proud of me.
But he's passed. He died. How much did your dad get to see?
I went further than what he got to see because when it went electronic, he wouldn't come to see. You know, when there were drum solos, he kind of stopped coming. It's like mum would come instead. yeah, he is old school in that way too, where there'd be a new CD and there'd be reviews and some press, and that is what he wants to see. You know, because he might not like the music, but he sees it's being received in a certain way, so cool. But it wasn't even music to him, it was just noise, you know.
And what did your mom think of all this?
My mom has been pretty cool. She's always been super supportive. She would come to gigs and bring her friends, and even now she'd be like, you know, what time are you playing? If I'm in New Zealand, I'm like, Mom, it's going to be really loud and there's nowhere to sit. It's like, okay, maybe I won't come to this one then. But if I get to do like a jazz gig in New Zealand, she'd love that. She's not, you know, a musician, but she's definitely a music fan. And I think, like any parent, when you see your kid doing something they love, that's pretty amazing.
You would know? Do you have kids?
Yeah. I have two boys. And, you know, they both have things they love doing. And it's great they're doing them. And it's funny because when they're doing those things as a parent, it's almost like, it's great you're enjoying this, but I'm a little scared if you want to do this as a career because I don't know if you're going to make it. But to be able to let go of that fear and just support them through what they love doing, and support them with the idea that, oh, you know, you want to be in the NBA? Let's go. It's all about encouraging what's possible, even if it might seem impossible. Whereas my dad would be like, you know, I talk about my plans for 5 years from now, back when I was 15 or something, and my dad would be like, oh, I'd be surprised if there is a world in 5 years from now.
Because he, like, foresaw the impending apocalypse or something, or?
He was an Armageddonist.
No! That too?
That too. My dad, he had an amazing life, like an incredible life. And some stuff happened to him at one point that shattered his idea of what reality was. In hindsight, I can see that from that point on, religion became his crutch. Well, it defined reality for him, because his definition of reality had just been wiped away. It affected material life in a drastic way. And so, yeah, religion became his thing. And I think he liked religion when it was super controlled. When you get into very traditionalist, Christian, Bible kind of doctrine or orthodoxy, and you get to something like the Book of Revelations, and you take that literally, then, you know, you're probably going to say stuff like that. I don't know if there will be a world in 5 years' time.
Getting a sense of your vibe, you don't strike me as the most religious man in the world. When did you identify for yourself that this wasn't for you?
Really early. In New Zealand, my parents had me going to a Anglican school. And it just didn't gel, like, straight away. I remember being 11, maybe, and we'd have a class. It was called Divinity, was the name of the subject, right? We'd challenge the teacher in the most horrific ways. It was all verbal, but we'd just be asking, because he was a man of the cloth, you know? And we'd be asking questions that were just totally inappropriate. I love spirituality. I love the fact that we're more than our skin and bones. I love that there's a connectedness between all people and all humanity.
Well, the fact that you heard this Glenn Miller recording of all things on WBGO, and you think that that is actually, there's something more than just the coincidence of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know there's more than coincidence to that. You know, things happen in a very intentional way. I'm a strong believer in free will, but if you're in your flow, then things just happen that remind you that you're in your flow right now.
Mark DeClavlo, I'm going to leave it at that. Thanks again for coming and spend some time with us.
Thank you, man.
Mark DeClavlo. Yes. Exclusive Blue Note mixtape. Yes. John Robinson in the place.
No doubt.
Uh-huh. Vibes. Yup. Vibes. Let's go. Let's go, man. Picture perfect like the great day in Harlem type stardom. Before Twitter, we were scripting and building a following. Organic push the panic button type dope. And everything he spoke was a profound quote. Dynamic, candid, running rampish, outlandish. Almost two decades since we expanded across the Atlantic. Feel the pain of the temptations when the pen's shaking. The masses awakening, thought forms hard to explain. It's channeled. Worldwide broadcast angles, it tangles around the minds of people far away and close by. Intimate locals, they hear the vocals. I give thanks to all of the world I ever spoke to. Pristine pure, crisp clean raw, nutrient exuberant and obscurely morgue. Bright rhymes and life and times of our story. Black clouds, clear blue skies, it's all glory. Face it, there's obstacles that can't be erased, kids. Life is an initiation, we floating in space, dig. It's bigger than hip hop and looking cool. No longer smart to be dumb, nah, we shook the rules. Straight lace, no crooked jewels. Spoon feed the mass, eye towel stool. Enough healing fools, cool. We taking steps higher than before. Supply and demand, we came through the door. It's raw, the world, what? It's yours, yeah, it's yours, yes. Revolve evolution, a music revolution. Looking back to move forward to make better music. Revolve evolution, a music revolution. Looking back to move forward to make better music. Revolve evolution, a music revolution. A music revolution, music revolution. Music revolution, music revolution. Revolve evolution, music revolution.
That's Mark DeClivelo's underground mixtape, Blue Note Remixed Volume 1, featuring the rapper John Robinson. Mark DeClivelo paying homage to all of his favorite sounds from the legendary Blue Note record label. You can find it on Bandcamp. If you enjoyed this podcast, well, there's going to be more Mark DeClivelo coming soon. Again, this Wednesday night, we're going to Berklee College of Music, Cafe 939's Red Room, where we're going to be bringing you a live webcast of Mark DeClivelo's new quartet. And then you can go see him at the Brick Jazz Festival the following night. And definitely, definitely, definitely go to our website at wbgo.org and check out the NPR Music Jazz Night in America video we made with Mark DeClivelo in LA, where he explains his process. I'd like to give a special shout out to our production intern, Anthony Nieves. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rentner. Thanks for checking us out.